From the Partnership for Public Service, you're listening to Transition Lab, a behind-the-scenes look at presidential transitions. I'm David Marchik. Today on Transition Lab, we're going to talk about the presidency itself. When a president-elect transitions to office, what will he or she have to do? To talk us through those issues, we're lucky to have John Dickerson. John is currently a correspondent for 60 Minutes, and he was previously the host of Face the Nation. He was a Time magazine writer for a dozen years. He's really not a typical journalist in any respects. He's a historian. He hosts a popular podcast called Political Gabfest, and he's written several fantastic books. His most recent book, The Hardest Job in the World, The American Presidency, explores how the job of the American president became so difficult and what we might do about it. John, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let me start with your career, because I always like to learn about people's backgrounds and their careers. And how did you get started in journalism? And what influence did your mom, who was a famous journalist herself, have on your career?
Well, I guess I got involved in journalism sort of despite myself. If you talk to the teenage version of me, would have been very surprising that I went into journalism, just because, you know, I had a version of the teenage conflicts with my mother in particular. And so to have gone into her profession would have been something I never would have planned. In school, though, I studied literature and history and became fascinated with storytelling. And then, you know, not just fiction, but the story of America. Presidential campaigns in particular have been something I've been very interested in. You know, the narrative of campaigns is all right there in front of you. It's all set up. There's a defined ending. There's a narrative path. And then the romantic version of Washington legislation and how it's put together and how interests clash and combat with each other and some of the amazing characters that have been a part of the American story all captivated me. And then just that interest in storytelling kind of captured me and never let go.
Well, one of the things I've admired about you is the way you interview, and you do it in a very thoughtful, cerebral, and non-combative way. You've interviewed a bunch of presidents. Which president has been the most difficult to interview?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because they're all difficult in different ways. I mean, President Trump is difficult because he's quite combative. He doesn't answer questions that he doesn't want to answer. He tries to create a contentious relationship with the questioner for whatever reason. But on the other hand, he will sometimes say things that are quite blunt and quite candid. And you get a pretty clear sense of who he is when you interview him, because the Donald Trump you see is the full Donald Trump. President Obama is quite thoughtful, but sometimes at the end of a 25-minute answer, you can only ask a few questions, because he'll give you an answer that covers the entire landscape of an issue, which is complete and thoughtful, but it means it's very hard to interrupt and hard to kind of drive the interview towards what you think is the most important set of answers you want to try to get. President Bush, who I interviewed quite a lot during his presidency, was pretty candid, but when you would talk to him off the record, you knew there was a distance between his real candor and what he would say out loud. So they were all tricky in their own way.
So one of the things you have to do is balance respect for the presidency, but also you have to interrupt a little and bring people back to your questions, because they'll filibuster, like you said, maybe with Obama, 25-minute answer. So let's play this clip of you with President Trump.
How do you learn that skill? Who do you call to say, what's it like?
There's nobody you can call.
Did President Obama give you any advice that was helpful? That you think, wow,
he was very nice to me, but after that, we've had some difficulties. So it doesn't matter. You know, words are less important to me than deeds. And you saw what happened with surveillance, and everybody saw what happened with surveillance.
Difficulties how?
I thought that, well, you saw what happened with surveillance, and I think that was inappropriate.
What does that mean, sir?
You can figure that out yourself.
Well, the reason I asked is you said you called him sick and bad.
Look, you can figure it out yourself. He was very nice to me with words, and when I was with him, but after that, there has been no relationship.
But you stand by that claim about him?
I don't stand by anything. I just, you can take it the way you want. I think our side's been proven very strongly, and everybody's talking about it. And frankly, it should be discussed.
So what's your approach to interviewing President Trump and your strategy for kind of interrupting him or just letting him go?
Well, as you say, it's a balance because, and it depends whether it's live or you can edit it. If it's live, your viewers don't know why you're interrupting. They don't know the set of questions you've got that you want to get to and that you're nervous you won't get to because he's burning up the clock. And then sometimes they don't necessarily know immediately what he said that needs to be challenged or is incorrect or is just plain false. And so your desire to interrupt, which can end up being just a jumble of noise on the television screen, is an unpleasant thing for viewers to experience. Even if you're getting to the truth, you can't just keep doing that the whole time because one of your jobs as an interview is to be a window through which people see the person you're interviewing. And if you're interrupting too much, you cloud what they're able to see. On the other hand, you're not doing your job if after the interview is over, they've had a net reduction in knowledge because what they've heard is actually not the truth.
Well, we're taping this on September 24th, and yesterday on September 23rd, he was asked the question whether he would hand over power in a peaceful way, consistent with the 223 years of American history since Washington handed the keys to John Adams. And he said, well, we'll just have to see. I don't like the way the election is being done with the mail-in ballots. What was your reaction to that statement?
Well, I mean, my very first reaction is that the American system is founded on a structure, and that structure is the peaceful transition of power. You mentioned Adams. Adams and Jefferson were friends once, then became bitter enemies. But Thomas Jefferson said, basically, whichever of us wins this presidential contest, the country will be okay. Now, he might have been spinning. He might have been not sort of giving you a perfect window into his private desires. But there was a norm that he felt it was necessary to speak to. And that idea of a peaceful transition of power is one of the things that makes America great. And so even if the president didn't mean what his harshest critics interpreted him to mean, he was kind of kicking at one of the things that holds up that structure. He was playing around with something that really presidents have an opposite duty, which is not to kind of kick at one of the structures holding up the American system, but to protect it, to be a steward of it, to cool the passions about it, and to not do anything to raise doubts about the durability of the system.
Let's move to your book. You wrote a book, The Hardest Job in the World, describing the American presidency. Why did you write that book? And for our readers who should buy it and read it, what's the essential message in your book?
Well, I wrote the book because I've covered so many campaigns going back to 1992, and the presidency that's discussed in campaigns was always quite a bit different than the presidency I then covered when the winners came into office. And the shock is consistent across the modern presidency that presidents get into office and they say, wow, it's a lot different than I conceived of the job. And the voters have often felt that way too. And the difference between expectation and reality is the fertile ground for unhappiness, disappointment, and anger. And so if we thought more about what the job actually entails and what attributes are required to do it, maybe we would feel a little better about the electoral process and maybe pick even better presidents.
And one of the things you do is you spend a lot of time focused on, for example, the changes between Roosevelt and today. And we've spent a lot of time on Transition Lab, folks, on transitions. And we did an episode with Eric Rauchway, who wrote a wonderful book about the Hoover to Roosevelt transition. So when Roosevelt was preparing for office, what was the White House like then? And how does that compare to the White House today?
Well, the White House was just not equipped to deal with the modern age. And that's been a constant tension, really, from the beginning. Madison, upon leaving office, wrote a letter to Congress and said, you know, I got a few thoughts about some improvements you might make to the job so that the president isn't always weighed down with, you know, petty duties. And Congress didn't listen to him at all. They didn't listen to Teddy Roosevelt when he tried to do the same thing. And FDR came in and said, you know, there is so much that needs to be done. And there was obviously a spirit of action in the country, and he was trying to take advantage of that. And he essentially said the office is not equipped to handle the challenges of the day. And so he asked for really just a handful of aides and some basically efficiencies in the management of his different cabinet agencies. As it was designed at the time, he, in order to get aides and staffers to work for him, he basically had to borrow them from the cabinet agencies, which were far more independent than they are today. And all of this had to be run through Congress. And even asking Congress for additional aides and the power to restructure and basically tinker with the arrangement in the executive branch, even to make that request was seen as a kind of affront to the powers of Congress.
And one of the things you describe with Roosevelt is he spent an enormous amount of time in political capital to get six additional White House staffers, six. Today, the White House has 400 plus a bunch of detailees. And so, you know, what's the impact of the enormous growth of the White House staff on the presidency?
Well, Roosevelt would be shocked at how big and unmanageable the executive branch is now. Well, you know, I mean, it's in part because of Roosevelt that it's gotten bigger. You know, the presidency with Roosevelt escalated the move in the nation to look to the presidency for answers to the problems that the country faces, and instead of either looking to Congress or looking to local governments. And so a president now is not in contact with a lot of the staff. And so you have this, one of the real tensions with the presidency now is the president has all of the political risk associated with action, but an organization that a president can't really run the way you would try to run a business. For example, the notion that a president can delegate has been talked about a lot. Jimmy Carter tried to run what was called a cabinet government, where he basically delegates a lot of the duties of the president out to his cabinet officials and his various secretaries of the departments. And in theory, that sounds great. And it's probably really the necessary solution to deal with the size of the to-do list a president faces. The problem is, as a political matter, if a cabinet secretary goes off and does something wrong, it's the president who gets blamed. And so for self-interested reasons, presidents tend to bring power into the White House. And when you do that, it's all very centralized, but that means it's hard to work quickly. It's hard to adapt. Your political minders get involved in what are probably better left as policy disputes. There are all these structural incentives for political reasons to keep power inside the White House building, but that makes it just very hard to work efficiently and basically to even develop a structure and an organizational hierarchy that makes it easy to get things done, because every president that comes in has to basically design their hierarchy from scratch while they're answering the challenges of the presidency, which hit the minute they are inaugurated.
You know, one of the things you argue is essentially the job is almost too big for one person, that it's just gotten so massive, the expectations are so large that it's impossible. But then you also tell a story in 1995, I was actually in the Clinton administration then and remember this, where Clinton was reduced. The Republicans had won the House, you know, he was very unpopular. And a reporter stood up at a press conference and asked him if he was still relevant. And here's what he said.
The important thing is for me to do these press conferences on a regular basis and every 3 or 4 months to do it at night so that anyone who wants to cover it can. The Constitution gives me relevance. The power of our ideas gives me relevance. The record we have built up over the last 2 years and the things we're trying to do to implement it give it relevance. The president is relevant here, especially an activist president.
So, John, what happened the next day and how did that prove that he was still relevant?
Yes. So when I was writing the book, I had forgotten that these two events happened in such close proximity. So on the 19th, Timothy McVeigh detonated a car bomb in front of the Alfred Murrow Federal Building in Oklahoma City, killing 168 people, among them 19 children who were in daycare in the building. And it immediately brought the president to the center of the American drama. And it was basically what Clinton had been arguing the night before, although he had talked about the power of his ideas and his record that made him relevant. And Bill Clinton stepped into the various roles that we ask a president to play. I mean, so on the one hand, he was explaining and describing to the country the manhunt and the law enforcement actions to find McVeigh. And then, of course, the kind of rescue and recovery efforts going on after that. But then also doing what presidents have been called to do in these acute moments, which is speak to the nation's pain, make sense of it to the extent that it is possible, and senseless acts, you can't make sense of them, but you can make them more orderly for people who are seeking order in these destabilizing moments. And he sought to do that because these 19 children were killed. He also spoke to and the First Lady, Hillary Clinton. They held an event in the White House with children speaking to them. And this was a mix of playing that pastoral role. And also, obviously, he did it for the political benefit of being able to sort of inhabit the role of the office in a larger way. And it was really, as one of the president's speechwriters said at the time, it was the first time that Bill Clinton had been a comforting, reassuring figure rather than an unsettling one. And that that many people think, and maybe they overdo it, but many people think that was the great turning point in his presidency.
And you actually describe that and kind of a duty that's not described in the Constitution, not described in law. And I love the way you described it as the duty of consolation. So how have different presidents exercised this duty of national consolation? And who's done it well? Who has not done it well?
Well, and this is one of the tricky things about the book and about the presidency, which is, as you say, this is not written in the Constitution. And obviously, there have been moments where presidents have had to speak to the nation. And you think of Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address as being one of the great speeches delivered to that spoke to a specific moment that reminded America of itself. And that captured, used the position of the presidency to set the country on a course. But what's happened now is presidents are called on to do this quite frequently. I mean, so the Oklahoma City bombing was a special case. The Challenger disaster was another. 9/11 was another. But in the age of school shootings and mass shootings, President Obama had to speak repeatedly in the wake of shootings to play this role. And so it's one of the burdens of the office is that we expect presidents to play that role a lot. And that's hard to do. And it also, you know, given the other things on a presidential, I mean, the presidential to-do list is very, very long. Something has to be trimmed. And yet it would be very hard to imagine trimming this from the job. Although it was not, again, as I say, a part of the job. Where I kind of first located this, and there are many ways in which this has grown in the presidency, but where I spent some time was after Hurricane Betsy in 1965. Lyndon Johnson went down to New Orleans in the 9th District, basically at the pleading of Senator Russell Long of Louisiana. And he saw basically an opportunity to play this central role in the American drama, and it paid off for him politically. And that was in keeping with his conception of the presidency, which was as a kind of paternal father of the country. And so in moments of worry, the father steps up and sort of says, it's going to be okay, and I'm here to help you. And so, you know, Johnson did it quite well. Reagan, after the Challenger disaster, gave sort of the perfect speech, much like Clinton's on Oklahoma City, but where you put the disaster in context, explain to America why it's a part of the sort of American mission and values, and then sort of settle people. President Obama had to do it quite a lot. His speech after the shootings at the Mother Emanuel Church, his speech and then singing Amazing Grace was one of the sort of most impressive pieces of American rhetoric. President Trump has not embraced this part of the job. It's not really in his skill set, and he's basically not really done it except in a kind of workmanlike fashion. And he's just decided that's just not going to be a part of the presidency as he sees it.
So you mentioned the word trimming, and essentially the thesis of your book is this is a really hard job and it's almost too big for one person. So what responsibilities would you trim from the presidency, and to whom would you assign those responsibilities?
Well, this is the challenge. I think the legislating process should just go back to Congress. And that requires a lot of reforms from Congress and also reforms in the way the structure of politics, which have led us to the highly partisan moment that we're in. But Congress needs to play its role in debating legislation out loud and forcing people to take votes about the issues of the day. There's a lot of protecting of members of Congress by their leaders. And Harry Reid did this, and Mitch McConnell does it, to protect senators from tough votes. And you talk to senators of both parties, and they will say, just let us vote, which means reinvigorate the legislative process so that Congress is doing a lot and the president is weighing in at the end, but that the president isn't the legislator in chief. And that would take some things off of the presidential plate. We shouldn't look to presidents to sign executive orders to get things done. We should put pressure on Congress, and the members of Congress should feel embarrassed by being incapable of answering the challenges of the day. And that would be one big area where you could see the redistribution of duties.
Let's turn to the subject of presidential transitions. That's our focus. The Partnership for Public Service focuses on effective transition and early planning. And your book essentially makes similar arguments. I want to quote something from your book. You said that the transition into office for a new president makes it nearly impossible for that person to start in a way that takes maximum advantage of the skills they bring with them. What did you mean by that?
Well, and my thinking on transitions over the last many, many years has, of course, been influenced and guided and helped by Max. Stiers. So I really owe him and the Partnership for Public Service for a lot of the thinking on this. And then also just in talking to administrations and going, you know, going all the way back to John Kennedy, who said, basically, I spent so much time getting to be president. I wish I'd spent more time learning how to be president. And when you just look and when you talk to people who have worked in White Houses all the way up to national security advisors and really to the very top, they all say, Mike, you walk in and you have all these plans and you think it's all going to be going one way. And then it absolutely is not as you expected. And then everything just starts flowing and you're just in a constantly reactive mode. And so the sooner you can get started thinking about, A, what the set of challenges are going to be, B, what your organizational structure is going to look like. Because what, as it was described to me, and I've never worked in a White House, so this is all based just on my reporting, is you pull in a bunch of type A people, you put them in their jobs, but the organizational chart is one that's kind of built ad hoc based on the talents and skills of the people in the various positions. But everybody's very ambitious, so there's a lot of overlapping duties. There's a lot of people who are playing on other people's turf. And they're all designing the structure while they're trying to use the structure to adequately do their jobs. And if you can start that process earlier, get everybody in their lanes in the right way and develop a team, and this really came in my reporting when I talked to members of administrations and CEOs and philanthropists and all kinds of other people who were leaders in their fields, and they basically said the team is the key thing. Mike Bloomberg says as mayor, when they asked him, what'd you do your first 100 days? He said, I built a team. And what he meant was, get a team in place, and then your team, and as Max has pointed out a million different times, that team can't necessarily be your campaign team. The two jobs are very different. But that's another way we mess with our transitions. Nobody who's worked and sweated and made all kinds of sacrifice to get a president elected, then when he goes to the Super Bowl, you know, doesn't want to be left back at home. You know, they want to come to Washington, but they may not be really fit for the job. And that incentive to bring everybody that got you in the office in the first place is one of the many hurdles that makes transitions and fielding a good team difficult.
And Max Stiers should get an enormous amount of credit for bringing the art of transitions to a new high every cycle. And, you know, that's the essence of what we're focused on. You also write about a 12-month shakedown where basically a new president gets settled. So does it really take that long for a president to get his or her sea legs? And if Joe Biden were to win, would he need 12 months to really be ready?
I think Biden would need one. I mean, he would kind of know where things stand and he would have the reflexes and the sense of how the place is supposed to work better than anybody since George Herbert Walker Bush, and maybe even better because of his, you know, long service in the Senate if he decides that he wants to try to make policy through the Senate. Although in today's partisan world, that's really difficult. People fantasize about Reagan and Tip O'Neill, but that's a long, long time ago, and the structure of politics is so, so much different. But the reason Biden would need time is just getting your team in place. You may think Joe is great for this job, and then once Joe gets in the job, you think, you know what, he's not so great for that job. And so I need to put Joe somewhere else. And Sally, turns out, would be fantastic for, you know, as White House counsel. But so let's move her over from over at the State Department. I mean, so it takes a little while once people are in their jobs to get a sense of A, what you need because you're reacting to events, but then also how the various players work in their jobs. So I think while Biden would certainly start with a real head start, that period of acclimation is still really important.
Right. And what about Trump? So Trump has had a kind of contentious and up and down first term. You write extensively about just the challenges of a second term. How would President Trump approach the presidency differently were he to win a second term, in your view?
Well, I'm not quite sure. I mean, I can guess because he's not a fan of systems. He's not a fan of process. His turnover has set records for both the number of people in top spots and then the serial turnover in those top spots. So nobody I've talked to or interviewed in any walk of life says that is a good way to run a railroad. And so it doesn't seem that the president is suddenly going to snap into believing in the benefits of structure, the benefits of patience, and kind of doing things by a system. So I think it would be the same kind of exciting challenges that we've seen in the first term.
Let me ask you one final question. You give a number of recommendations for ways to change the presidency. If you were to say, here's one major reform that we could make to the American presidency and it would benefit the country, what would that reform be?
I think the reason I wrote the book is to change our expectations about what a president can do. And so this isn't a law. It's basically to stop putting the president at the center of the American system for everything, to not think of the president as a celebrity who can behave like an action hero and get things done, to put more pressure on Congress to do what it needs to do. And by focusing more on Congress, we might focus more on some of the reforms that would be necessary to find a way to elect members of Congress who are not so ideologically driven. You know, part of the problem of making the presidency into a celebrity office is that we've now created off-year elections and elections for Congress and the Senate that are basically driven by national politics, that are driven by the president's approval rating. President Trump has been incredibly successful wielding the power of the presidency to keep his team in line. But that's created a situation in which those members are basically so tied to the president that they lose their independence, which again centers everything in the presidency. So I would just hope that people might just stop paying as much attention to the presidency, which is a really weird thing for a person who's written a book about the presidency to say. But what the Partnership for Public Service works on is that recognizes that a president leads an organization. Again, this is not something that's in law, but it's in just in mindset, which is the president leads an organization. It is not an office of one person. And the more we focus on the idea that it is an organization and that you have members in that organization who play crucial roles, powerful roles, roles that contribute to the improvement or not improvement of American life, we may just think about the presidency differently and pay a little more attention to those other parts of the job. So I guess it's really just a change in mindset that I would hope for.
You know, I mentioned that was going to be my last question, but then I can't resist, which is, you've moderated debates. You've been part of designing debates. Next week, we have a debate. So what do you expect from the debate? And what questions would you ask were you to be the moderator next week?
I've been thinking a lot about this because why do we have debates? What's the point? They're really not. ABC, in the very first debates in 1960 between Nixon and Kennedy, wouldn't even call it a debate. They said, this isn't a debate. We're just going to call it a joint appearance. And that's kind of been the way it's always been. There are moments when the debates break out, where the two candidates exchange ideas, but the time pressures and the structure don't really allow for debate. Because Jill Lepore has written this in The New Yorker. Sometimes you want the candidates to have to just address one single issue for 90 minutes or maybe an hour, because what that does is it forces them to have more than just a two-minute answer. You can have a two-minute answer on anything. But what you have to do when you have a debate over an hour is you get behind those first answers to find out what values the presidents and the candidates bring to these issues. And those values are the really interesting thing to me in debates, because it's a format that seems to me to be one of the few where we can really get a window, and it's really hard, but a window into what these people are going to be like in the moment when they're alone and they have to make these momentous decisions that they have to make as president. It's tricky to ask that in a debate because a lot of the people in the audience would think, why are you asking this question? I want to know what they think about, you know, global warming. My view is, you know what they think about global warming. We've been talking about that for months, and they've got position papers and all the rest of it. So can you use the debates to excavate information that is a little bit closer to some of the things you would want to know in terms of whether they can actually do the job? And those kinds of questions don't really get uncovered in the other ways we cover presidential campaigns.
Well, John Dickerson, thank you for your time. Thanks for your advice on the presidency. And thanks for all your great work on the issue of presidential transitions and the American presidency. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, and I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
If you like Transition Lab, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.